Steel tariffs, overtime rules, and the election all in one interview. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Wednesday, everybody. This one is the 18th of May. Good as always to have you along. Over the next couple of months, we are going to be checking in with some of our regulars to get a sense of where their economies are as this election cycle wears on. We're going to start today with Lisa Goldenberg. She is the president of the Delaware Steel Company of Pennsylvania, which means she's got a vested interest in a couple of headline news items today, also the election as well. Lisa, it's great to talk to you again.
Hey, great to speak with you.
So first things first, the news of the day, these overtime rules. You are an employer in this economy. How are you feeling about it?
Well, I guess we kind of expected it. But I think that the way we think of employees who are in the 20-something thousand-dollar range versus employees that are in the 40-something, high 40 range, we tend to not think of those people as hourly people. I know in my company, I give them an enormous amount of autonomy. It's the Halloween parade. You should, you know, go see the kids and make up the time on the back end. God forbid you have a family funeral. Do what you need to do. Right. And treating them as hourly is going to be a real difference in a notion.
All right, new topic.
Sure.
The steel tariffs that were announced yesterday, 500-something percent on cold-rolled steel from China. I want to ask you, first of all, how's the steel business in America today?
Well, since you and I have last spent time together, we are in a different world. Things are hot, hot, hot.
Wow.
Like,
what does really nuts look like? Do you have steel flying out the door, basically?
Steel's flying out the door. Everyone's inventories are short. We are in a short position as a country. And
that is to say, not enough steel.
That is not enough steel. And that's real different from the last couple times that you and I have spoken where we were really in the doldrums. Now, I think this is a momentary thing. And I've been getting calls all day, every day. What does momentary mean? And what does the crystal ball look like?
Yeah.
It's because it's exciting and people are happy. The big steel mills are going to make money for the first time in a while. So that's all good. You know, we want profitable steel in the United States.
Do you feel the Chinese imports and the low prices that they're trying to get?
Well, up until the fall and through some of the winter months, sure, I felt it every day. My inventory was underwater, meaning that whatever I bought it for, somebody else could go buy something from the Chinese literally down the street cheaper. It affects me every day.
Yeah.
It's big news.
All right. Third topic. Since I have you and since you're a regular, I want to bang out one more. To what extent do you think your economic future is tied to the results of this election?
I don't know in today's world that anything is tied much. If Washington's, let's ask the question differently. So I put it back to you. If Washington does so little on a daily basis, it appears, and things are so slow to progress, what would any one election in theory?
Well, in theory, except this election.
Theory.
Yeah, in theory, except this election has had a lot of talk of tariffs. It's had a lot of talk of free trade. I mean, it's been that, you know, your issues have been up there.
Right. So I don't know that anyone's candidate per se as a business owner is in the election. As a woman, as a business owner, I was a registered Republican for forever. When Hillary ran last time, I changed my registration to support her. Would I necessarily do that today? Probably not. It would be real hard for me to support Donald Trump. I'm not a Bernie Sanders kind of gal. So where does that leave a business owner? I'm a centralist. I'm a trader. I'm an entrepreneur. Neither is really representing that group.
Lisa Goldenberg is the president of Delaware Steel of Pennsylvania. She is always good for a phone call. We're going to talk to you again in a couple of months, all right?
Sounds great.
All right.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Late breaking stock of the day, TSLA. Look it up. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The slump in oil and gas prices has meant huge layoffs in those industries. Bad enough in the best of circumstances, but for foreign workers here, legally on what are known as H-1B visas, for them, losing a job means having to leave the country. From Houston, Brenda Salinas has the story.
Scottish-born Graham Slavin lives in Katy, Texas, an area with lots of expats from the UK with experience in the oil business. In his comfortable, traditionally American subdivision living room, he tells me how much he's enjoyed living here these last 7 years.
We like the fact that it's easy to make friends here. We like the fact that the education system is fantastic. And we enjoy being able to live in a house that, for the same price back in the UK, would be about a third or a quarter of the size.
When his bosses called him into their office a few weeks ago, Slavin knew he was getting laid off. He could see it coming.
I wasn't in shock then. I could read the situation.
Slavin survived several rounds of layoffs since 2014. In just a few months, he saw his entire expat community shrink.
I actually got to the point where I couldn't face going to any more going away parties. They were happening with increasing regularity.
Slavin was in line to get a green card. He owns a home. His sons play on local soccer teams. His youngest, Niall, who's 9, has lived here since he was a toddler.
There are only, like, 2 people that I know that live in Scotland.
And how many people do you know here?
Let me see. A lot.
Slavin met most of his expat friends at a local golf club.
Every Friday during Lent, we had fish and chips, and we'd have a big crowd that showed up for that. And you know, if an Englishman tells you the fish and chips are pretty good, you got thumbs up.
Richard Rowell is the manager of the Willowfort Country Club. The exodus has hit them pretty hard these last couple of months.
We've been down probably about maybe 80 to 100 families have relocated to their home country, primarily because of job changes and the change in the economy.
Slavin has a type of visa called an H-1B. 85,000 of them are allotted every year to professional workers through quotas to different countries. Legally, once you're terminated, you have few options.
Much like Captain Kirk might be beamed up by Scotty, in theory, when an H-1B worker is terminated from employment, he should vaporize and disappear.
Lawyer Ken Hardin has seen the impact of this directly.
I would say since about 8 a.m. on January 4th, the first business day of this year, we have been furiously busy dealing with inquiries both from companies that need to downsize as well as individuals who have been or are about to be downsized. And so it's been a real profound issue given the local economy here in Houston these last several months.
However, there is one small chance for Slavin. If he can find another employer willing to sponsor him, he can stay. But he knows that's unlikely.
The best case scenario is a miracle that somebody else is interested in employing me. The chances of that at this point in time are pretty slim.
The few companies sponsoring H-1B visas in Houston right now are mostly in IT. That's not an area Slavin has experience in. Right now, he's trying to figure out a way to stay just until the end of the school year before he moves his family back to Scotland, a move he's trying desperately to avoid. In Houston, I'm Brenda Salinas for Marketplace.
One ventures into conversations about the bond market at one's own risk. Important, yes, but not the most gripping of topics, I think we can agree. Herewith, though, an exception that wraps in the global economy, geopolitics, and national security. Earlier this week, in response to a Bloomberg News Freedom of Information Act request, we should say, the Treasury Department disclosed for the first time how much U.S. debt is held by Saudi Arabia. That is, how much in dollars the Saudis hold in treasury bonds. Andrea Wong wrote the story. Andrea, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This information about Saudi holdings of U.S. treasuries has been secret up till now. Why?
Yeah. So the story has to go all the way back to the fall of 1973, when the U.S. had a big oil shock because of Arab countries imposed an oil embargo on us. It really hurt the U.S. economy a lot. It widened the budget deficit. And what the Treasury was trying to do at that time was trying to get the petrodollar back into the United States. We've paid these countries a lot of money for their oil, and now we want it back to fill our budget deficit and basically get the country running. So it was kind of like a trade-off, you know. We'll keep your holding secret, but buy our bonds, basically. So that's lasted for 40 years.
Put it into context for me. I mean, we all know, or we hear all the time, that the Chinese have, you know, $1 trillion plus or minus of American debt. Where do the Saudis fall on the global scale?
Right. So according to Treasury data, which doesn't provide a complete picture of their true holdings, their holdings stood at around $120 billion as of March, which, like you said, compared to China, Japan, which is way north of $1 trillion, doesn't look that much. But then the question becomes, is that it, or they are putting it somewhere else?
Help me understand why transparency on the holders of U.S. debt is important.
We want to know who owns us, right? The U.S. has the world's biggest and deepest, most liquid bond market, except for, you know, a short period during the 90s when we were able to close the budget deficit. We've always been, you know, borrowing more than, you know, we could afford just to spend. So it's really important who owns us, right? And around 60% of all treasuries are actually owned by foreign holders, such as China, Japan.
60%, right?
Yes, a little less than two-thirds. Yeah. So it's important to understand what our relationship with these countries are and how much debt they have.
There has been much made the past couple of days of Saudi threats to sell off its holdings of U.S. debt in response to disclosures about September 11th and possibly what the Saudis might have known or done. Do you think that's a real threat? Do you think the Saudis would actually unload their holdings?
That's a very good question. I think the figure came from a Times piece back in April when the Times reported that Saudi Arabia officials were threatening to sell $750 billion of treasuries and other holdings in the U.S. if that bill is passed. The question becomes, wow, $750 billion is a really big number. Where else can you put it, right? And the reality is there's not that many places where you can put that large chunk of money in and still have a positive yield. I mean, I can't say it's an empty threat because they might well really try to do it if that bill is passed. But it's a lot more complicated than just simply saying that.
Andrea Wong writes for Bloomberg, this time specifically about Saudi Arabia and its holdings of American debt. Andrea, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Refugees by the hundreds of thousands, as we have all heard, have been trying to get to Europe this year from places like Syria and Iraq, risking their lives to escape violence and economic hardship, crowded refugee camps, and increasingly hostility from the locals. But a growing number of people are returning to northern Iraq specifically because what they found in Europe was far from what they had hoped for. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from northern Iraq.
In the Bahaka camp for displaced Iraqis near Erbil, Saad Kamal's daughters say they've been here too long, and they ask, why don't they give us houses and the other things we need? They're among nearly 3 million Iraqis who fled their homes. Some try to make it to Europe, but Saad himself says there's no place like home.
We've been 2 years in these camps. We are a family of eight. People like their own country. Some who went to Europe or Turkey came back. What we want is to go home soon, if it's safe.
Saad and his family fled from Mosul, so did their neighbor Akram. He didn't want to give his full name because he still has relatives living there under so-called Islamic State. We'd like to leave, Akram said, because we have no future in Iraq. Some friends went and were given houses and jobs, and there were schools for the kids. But we don't have the money to make the journey, so we're stuck here. The last few months have seen a significant drop in the number of migrants reaching Europe through Greece or Italy. Sandra Black from the International Organization for Migration says that's been accompanied by a big increase in people actually returning to Iraq from Europe.
First 8 months of 2015, we had 100 average returnees per month. But since then, it's drastically increased. This past month, we had nearly 1,000 Iraqis who requested ILN assistance to return home.
Safin Ismail, an Iraqi Kurd, is another of those who came back. He made it to Germany last year, but after 3 months, there was no prospect of a residence or work permit, so he came back.
By the time I got there, Germany was flooded with the refugees, and they stopped giving residence permits. So there was no better life. Now that I am back, if you people tell me they want to go, I advise them not to.
The BBC's Jim Muir reporting for us in northern Iraq. Coming up.
The notion that this could have been stolen to order for some Mr. Big or Dr. No character normally is not the case, especially something like this.
When you're an amateur thief, oh, trust me, it shows. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 3 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 17,526. The NASDAQ increased 23 points, about a half percent, 4739. The S&P 500 up less than a point, essentially unchanged, 2047. Big gains in banking as Wall Street saw hints in the Fed's April minutes released today about a possible interest rate hike next month. Goldman Sachs deposited 3.4%. Bank of America secured 4.8% today. Tesla announced a stock offering after the bell. It needs $2 billion to build the Model 3. Shares down 1.2% after hours. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.85%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's not necessarily how a lot of us would spend an otherwise beautiful Northern California afternoon, but software engineers are going to software engineer, I guess. Today was the first day of something called Google I.O. The company took the opportunity to roll out its newest and hopefully for them whiz-bangiest piece of hardware. Our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood is there. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai. How are you?
I'm good. Make me smart. What exactly is Google I.O. before we get to the whiz-bang stuff?
Yeah, Google I.O. is their developer conference. So this is where engineers and developers who are interested in writing programs and apps and software for Google's platforms come to learn about the latest tools, the latest kind of tech specs.
Tell me about this thing they unveiled today, Google Home. What is it?
Yeah, Google Home is basically Google's answer to the Amazon Echo, and it's a way for them to use what has been actually really good voice recognition technology that they've had for a long time as the basis, basically the platform for an in-home appliance, the kind of thing that you talk to and you ask it for information and you have it set reminders and you use it to play music. So it's a little gadget that you talk to, just like the Echo.
So If Google is now getting into this space, here's my question. Amazon was here first, so Google is behind. I can probably also tell my Amazon Echo to order me a new container of laundry detergent too, right? Because Amazon does that. What is Google's competitive advantage in this space?
The competitive advantage is that powering the information inside this device is Google. And Google actually has a huge head start in terms of voice recognition technology, but also contextual technology. Anybody who uses Google Now, which is built into the Android phones, knows that, you know, it knows where you parked your car. It knows when you have airline reservations. It knows when you have calendar appointments and meetings you need to get to. And on top of that, it has Google Search. So for anybody who really wants useful information about their day-to-day, it's a pretty big advantage and it's a pretty compelling product that I should point out here, though, does not exist yet.
Well,
and
yeah,
won't be coming out
right
until sometime later.
That's the thing. I mean, Google does this repeatedly, right? They have these big whiz-bang things, and then they say it's eventually coming, and it turns out to be less.
Yeah, that is the story of Google I.O. almost every year, is that you get some really amazing-looking technology, and you don't know when it's going to come out.
Did anybody raise their hand and ask whoever was doing the presentation on this thing, hey, listen, Amazon's already here in this space. You've got this FaceTime lookalike, and Apple's already got that.
It's very common for these events to be a little bit of vaporware and to talk about products that aren't coming out for a long time. What's interesting here is that this is the first Google I.O. that we've seen since Alphabet was created. The first time that Google has had to stand alone and say, this is what we got, right? We don't have the parachuting Google Glass guys anymore, because that's another division.
Alphabet, we should remind people, is the corporate restructure that they did last year sometime. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. When this thing hits store shelves this fall, or when you order it online, which is the way we do things now, if you had your choice between this thing and an Amazon Echo, which one are you going to buy?
That's such a hard question, because one is real and one is not real. No, you know what? To me, the only big shortfall of Amazon Echo is that it's not connected to Google and it can't just give me information from the World Wide Web. So I would take the Google Home product if it's even remotely comparable in price.
Wow. Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent, on the scene there at Google I.O. at the Shoreline Amphitheater in Silicon Valley. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Even those among us who don't know a whole lot about art would probably recognize Andy Warhol's Campbell soup cans, right? Icons of early 1960s pop art that they are. Last month, part of a set of Warhol's Campbell prints, including tomato and chicken noodle, that is the good soups, were stolen from the Springfield Art Museum in Southwest Missouri. Hanging on the wall, they were worth about $500,000. Sitting in the back of a thief's closet or someplace else, the value proposition is a bit tougher. Laura Spencer has that story.
Museum director Nick Nelson stands inside a quiet gallery in a new wing of the building. Gray carpeting, white walls, and track lighting.
You see, this whole wall here, that was a space where we had the Warhols displayed.
That is until early the morning of April 7th, when seven of Andy Warhol's Campbell's soup can screen prints were stolen.
Our reaction is one of shock and sadness.
The Warhol prints were a source of pride, says Nelson. And because works of paper are sensitive to light, they'd only been on view a handful of times at the museum since 1985.
You know, certainly it's quite a blow to have something like this happen, not only due to the loss of the artwork, but also just the invasion of space.
Andy Warhol's classic soup can paintings date to 1962, and 250 sets of prints were made in 1968, each with 10 soups.
Tomato, black bean, onion, pepper pots, all kinds of different soups.
Denver art dealer Monica Brown says these days the soup can prints sell for about $40,000 to $45,000 each, and tomato soup, she says, is the favorite. Maybe it's childhood memories with grilled cheese sandwiches. One sold recently at auction for more than $100,000. Actually, who stole them is a mystery, but there is one strong likelihood.
About 89% of museum thefts in the United States are inside jobs.
Robert K. Whitman is a former senior investigator with the FBI's art crime team. For more than 25 years, he's chased down paintings, prints, and sculptures, sometimes going undercover. Here, he says, there were signs that thieves were amateurs because they stole well-known Warhol prints but didn't take the full set.
I mean, first of all, they're very identifiable. Secondly, you take 7 out of 10, and that diminishes the value of the whole collection.
So it looks like they were opportunistic thieves. No mastermind here.
The notion that this could have been stolen to order for some Mr. Big or Dr. No character normally is not the case, especially something like this.
Turbo Paul Hendry runs 2 art theft blogs. He knows his stuff. He started out as a con man, going door to door, trying to buy artwork or antiques for less than they're worth. Stolen art often goes to a trusted hand, Hendry says, someone who buys stolen goods for not a lot of money.
So they would perhaps sell them for, say, $10,000. Then the person that buys them for $10,000 maybe would then sell them to what's called a criminal venture capitalist, who may pay $20,000 for them, wrap them up, and then put them away.
Until interest dies down, which could mean years. Other options, the works could be sold to a drug dealer or exchanged for narcotics. Of course, someone in the know could lead the police to where the prints are, especially for a reward. The FBI says rewards are considered generally effective, although there's no real data. They've offered $25,000 in this case, and Hendry says that could be an incentive.
In this instance, $25,000 on $500,000 worth of stolen Warhols is actually round about 5%, which is actually quite good.
Springfield Art Museum officials are hoping their situation won't be like what's been described as the holy grail of art heists. Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, where $500 million worth of artwork has still not been recovered after nearly 30 years. In Kansas City, I'm Laura Spencer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, ending in a way where we started: worker pay. The board of directors at Viacom voted today to stop paying the salary of its 92-year-old founder and chairman emeritus, Sumner Redstone. Until this afternoon, Redstone made about $2 million a year. Symbolism, of course, here is everything. Redstone is worth something like $5 billion American dollars. You might remember he just won a legal fight over his mental competency a couple of weeks ago. Hi, Kai Rizdahl here. Thanks for listening to this Marketplace podcast. We give you the context you need to understand what's happening in the economy and why it matters to you. So here's some context on us. We're a nonprofit service, and we rely on donations from our listeners to keep on going. And we've just made special Let's Do the Numbers Pilsner glasses available to thank you for your support. So please donate today at marketplace.org. All right, got to go. The Dow and the S&P basically flat today. The NASDAQ up 23 points, about a half percent. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.